Welcome to Philosophy as a Way of Life. I'm your host, Massimo Piliucci from the City College of New York. And with me is my co-host, as usual, Rob Coulter from the University of Wyoming. Hi, Rob. How are you?
Hi, Massimo. How are you today?
I am good. I'm in beautiful Rome with a nice temperature and a great day. What is the situation in Wyoming?
Well, as often this time of year, it's snowy and not that cold, just a little bit below freezing. So.
All right. That could be worse. Now, our guest today is in yet a third place in the world, although not that far from me. We're welcoming our returning guest, Robin Waterfield, who will be talking about translating Epictetus. Robin is an independent scholar and translator living in southern Greece. In addition to 30 volumes of translations of works of Greek literature, he is the author of numerous books ranging from children's fiction to Greek history. Most recently, The Making of a King, published by the University of Chicago Press. Robin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I am very much looking forward to this conversation. Rob, as usual, you want to ask the first question?
Yeah, sure. So happy to get started. I just did want to start by saying I enjoyed poking around in your translation quite a bit. Glad to have it on, available for people. It's got a lot of virtues, I think. So maybe we'll just start with sort of a general question. Would you have sort of a general shtick if somebody were to ask what Epictetus is all about? Is there a general sort of thing you'd want to say to start?
I think Arrian, the compiler of the handbook, said it best. It's some things are up to us and some are not. That's absolutely the core of what Epictetus is saying, and everything else that he says follows from that. Some things are up to us and some things are not. And therefore we have to accept the things that are not up to us, such as our health and our role in life and so on and so forth, and work only with the things that we can make a change, which are chiefly our internal states, our responses to events rather than the events themselves. That's it in a nutshell. I think that's what Epictetus is up to.
Okay. Want to follow up on that, Massimo?
Well, yeah. So that implies a sort of or leads directly to a next obvious question, which is, in your experience and your understanding, how does Epictetus differ from other Stoics? Right. So there's the so-called dichotomy of control or the fundamental rule of life, etc. But what was your impression? You've translated Marcus Aurelius, for instance, who was, of course, influenced by Epictetus, at least in part. But generally speaking, how do you situate Epictetus among the other Stoics?
Yeah. First, as an aside, I think Epictetus's influence on Marcus was huge. I mean, I think that is chiefly what he was reading and where he was getting his ideas from. Anyway, as a Stoic, Epictetus doesn't differ from other Stoics. I mean, we say that knowing full well as scholars that, having lost nearly all the work of the earlier Stoics, we're actually reliant on these Roman Stoics for a lot of our information about Stoicism. But I still dare to say that essentially Epictetus is an orthodox Stoic, and therefore what he's saying is the same as what other Stoics would have said if we had their works, if they survived. But what I think is special about Epictetus, where he's great and why he's really important, is first of all his clarity. His as a teacher, he's very he hammers home the same points over and over again. And secondly, the reason why he's capable of doing this is, to go back slightly to what I was saying before, is that he saw his job as a teacher as cutting through the complexities of Stoicism and going straight to its heart, straight to its core. And the way he formulated that core was what I was saying before. Some things are up to us and some are not. As far as we know, nobody had ever put it quite like that before him, but he draws out from that everything which is standard Stoicism anyway. So I think that's where he differs. He differs because he was at heart a teacher, and as a teacher, he kept things as straightforward as possible. So he was going straight, as it were, to the heart of each of his students.
Right. So just as a brief follow-up, on the one hand, Epictetus is often presented as you just did, as a classic Stoic. He arches back to Chrysippus and to the early Athenian Stoics. And so in that sense, he's perfectly within the general sort of Stoic canon. Of course, we also know that he was strongly influenced by his teacher, Musonius Rufus, and so on. But yeah, the so-called dichotomy of control does seem to be a rather, at least in the formulation that Epictetus has, rather novel. I mean, I can't think of an earlier Stoic, of course, with the big caveat that you just put forth, which is we lost most of what the early Stoics were writing. But I, like, for instance, I can't find anything like that in, let's say, Seneca or any of the fragments that we have from Diogenes Laertius. Or do you have any direct connection?
No. Mm-hmm. It's what I said. Nobody that I know of has put it that way. Still, Epictetus draws out of that. What he draws out of it is standard Stoicism, I think.
I agree. I would agree. That's right. It's central.
I'm saying that as a teacher, he found this neat and simple way to. He likes to keep, like Marcus Aurelius, he's always telling his students, Marcus is telling himself, of course, not his students, but he's always telling his students, you know, remember this, keep this idea close at hand, he uses, or at hand is a phrase he uses a great deal. And so, you know, that's what we get in the Meditations as well, in Marcus, that they are repeating core neat sayings. To drive them home, to make them memorable. Some things are up to us and some aren't. What could be more memorable than that?
Yeah, exactly. And sure enough, almost 2,000 years later, we're still using that phrase very widely. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the translation is not just a translation, right? You have a rather extensive introduction in which you summarize a number of Stoic points. I found that really thorough and thought-provoking in a number of cases, and I'd love to probably talk to you for hours about some things in it. But one bit that puzzles me, I was wondering if you could expand on a little bit for us, right? Mm-hmm. And by puzzles me is I think it's kind of hard to connect the idea of the relation between the idea of happiness, eudaimonia, right, and the idea of things that are indifferent in Epictetus in particular, but Stoicism in general, right? So you say, for example, that since happiness depends on our being in harmony with nature in all respects, and since health is our natural condition, it's a preferred indifferent. Yeah. Right? So I wonder if, when you describe that, if you're saying that what makes something preferred insofar as it's an indifferent that we prefer, right, is not simply that we prefer it, or is it some other connection with nature? And again, if happiness is just simply living in accord with nature, and things that are in accord with nature then are somehow good, then aren't preferred indifference also goods, right? So this is obviously a challenge that I think has been raised against Stoicism in a number of different ways, but I wondered if you could sort of expand on how you understand that a little bit for us.
It's very slippery. And as you implied just now, the Stoics were criticized for exactly this, even, you know, right from the beginning, right in ancient times. If you can describe happiness as being in a state of accord with nature, and if a preferred indifferent is one that's in accord with nature, then why can't we call it good? Why can't we call a preferred indifferent good? The preferred indifference include, let's have a short list before us so we know what we're talking about. Things like life, health, pleasure, beauty, strength, wealth, good reputation, and reasonably high birth, reasonably good status in society. And the dispreferred indifference include all the opposites: death, disease, pain, ugliness, and so on. Mm-hmm. Preferred indifference are those that foster a person's natural condition. It is natural to us to be healthy, not unhealthy. So preferred indifference are those that foster a person's natural condition, and so selecting them is approved by our rational faculty. That, of course, is always the Stoic way. But the reason I think that they're not to be called good is because, well, first of all, because only virtue is good. Preferred indifference can't be called good because they can be put to bad use, whereas, of course, virtue can never be put to bad use by definition. And so at one point in the discourses, Epictetus says, is health good and illness bad? No, man. What then? Health managed well is good, but when badly managed, it's bad. So health and all the other preferred indifference aren't good in themselves, but they're good when applied by our rational selves or something like that, when put to use by our rational selves. I think that's the answer he would give. But, you know, I'm slightly cautious because I confess to a certain philosophical sympathy with the criticism of the Stoics rather than with their position. So, but I think that's what I would say on their behalf.
So just as a quick follow-up then, right? So being preferred is not really a function of what we might or might not want, at least not unless we're a sage, of course, right? But is that right?
Yes, I think wanting is another difficult issue with preferred indifference, because if you want something, then you feel pleasure when you get it.
Right.
And the Stoics weren't very keen on pleasure on the whole. So that's another reason perhaps why preferred indifference aren't quite good, because you might want them and then you might feel pleasure when you get them. Something like that as well might be another way to defend their position.
So maybe one more little follow-up before. I wonder then, right, so do you think perhaps that being preferred is a funny way to translate the idea, which suggests something about, like, that it's, you know, kind of perhaps just going with our whims when that doesn't seem to be the way we understand it, when we tease it apart? Can you think of any better way to, we could put up with it? I ask partly because I want to, you know, copy whatever you say next time I teach it. But
Do you know, I can't think of what the Greek is for preferred, because the term preferred indifference doesn't occur in either Marcus or Epictetus. Right. So I can't off the top of my head just remember what they say. But what it would boil down to would be a paraphrase. You'd have to say something like indifference, which it's okay to select.
Yeah. Something I think there are phrases like things that are indifferent and in accord with nature or something like that. But that's,
yes, Marcus uses that one, for instance. Yeah.
I think that's in Diogenes Laertius as well. But
yeah.
It's pretty clunky.
Yeah. So perhaps scholars have gone for preferred indifference because it's less clunky, yeah.
Yeah, perhaps.
Well, you know, little bit of a follow-up on the discussion you two have just had. Robin, if I understand correctly, you don't actually identify as a Stoic.
That's correct.
You just said, right? So you just said a minute ago that you actually sympathize with self-criticism. So in a sense, then, it's interesting to say, so what is your take on Epictetus in particular, but also Stoicism in general, as a scholar who doesn't necessarily identify with the school? Because, of course, you are curious about the subject matter. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing, right? And and that, in a sense, does kind of imply some kind of positive attitude, but you're not buying into it. So what's going on in your mind about Stoicism in general? I guess that's what I'm asking. And if you like to share this, is there anything, any of the other Greek, Greco-Roman philosophies that strikes you as, personally, at a personal level, as more on target, let's say?
No, I think, it's a personal question, so I'll respond personally. And I think if I were younger and in search of my soul, as Jung put it, I'd have been very attracted to Stoicism as a path to follow. But at this phase of my life, I'm simply not hungry in that way. As Epictetus himself says, a potential follower of Stoicism, that the starting point is an awareness that something is not right with your life. This is what Gurdjieff called the terror of the situation. And I'm no longer motivated by this terror. I'm living where I'm supposed to live, with the person I'm supposed to be with, and I'm doing the work I'm supposed to be doing. So I'm sorry if this sounds smug, but I've kind of moved on from awareness that something is wrong with my life to a situation where there's really nothing wrong with my life. And to come to your second point, which is more important and because less personal, the work, as I said, that I'm supposed to be doing is scholarly work. There's a real danger for translators who are themselves committed to a path, whatever that path, Stoicism or Christianity or Buddhism or whatever it is. And the danger is that from time to time, they won't translate what's in the text, but what they want to be in the text. This is a danger that all translators face all the time, but I think it's particularly acute for people who are very committed followers of the path. They will read their own understanding of that path into the text. That's something as a scholar I have to avoid. And so I very rigorously avoided being a Platonist or anything else.
Yeah, it's similar, I guess, to the danger that is inherent in writing somebody's biography, right? So you have to have not only an interest, I guess, but also be somewhat sympathetic to your subject matter. Otherwise, you're likely not going to go do a good job. But at the same time, if you're too sympathetic to the subject matter, then you're going to be, writing
exactly so
far too positive. Yeah. So that's
exactly so. Man. Exactly so, Massimo. Yeah.
Rob.
Yeah. So let's maybe talk a little more about translation in general. Translating a text like this, maybe there's some general things you wanted to talk about, but one contrast I think of, I obviously probably haven't translated or read near as much in Greek as you have, but I remember back when I was a student, one of my professors used to talk about how translations always have to make choices of some sort. And I think of an example of reading Homer. When I was reading Homer as an undergraduate, this particular professor made us read two different translations, one of which he said was very literal, whereas the other one he said was, more poetic or artistic, had more style, right? And of course, Homer's a poet, where Epictetus is not really. But that's a balance. I've always sort of carried that, right? This balance between things like readability and being pleasant for the modern reader versus capturing what's going on in the text, and that maybe there's a tension between them sometimes. And I wonder if you could maybe speak to that issue in Epictetus in particular, but maybe in general as well.
I can certainly address it in general. I mean, the challenges of translating Epictetus were really no more or less than the challenges of translating any author. And it boils down very much to what you've just been saying. There's this tightrope you walk all the time, every sentence, every second or minute of the day when you're doing a translation, you're walking this tightrope between fluency, English fluency, and as literally accurate as you can get with the text. And that's the same whether you're doing Epictetus or Homer or anybody else. You've got to make sure also that the register and tone of voice are those of Epictetus, not Robin Waterfield. That was a lot of fun for Epictetus, because I really like Epictetus's brusque and abrasive teaching style. I like the way he castigates his students. He's saying things like, God, give me one student who's worthwhile. Things like that. I enjoyed that. But yeah, in all translation work, there's only that one debate. How the degree to which a translator should feel free to depart from the purely literal level of the text facing him. Can you still all hear me? I just had a message flash up on my screen saying my internet connection is unstable.
No, you're good.
So far, so good.
That happens quite a lot here in rural Greece. And as Rob implied, translators of poetic works must allow themselves, I think, a lot more leeway But I translate prose, not being a poet myself. And that issue of what degree of latitude do you allow yourself in order to make the text more readable and more enjoyable by modern English readers, as opposed to, you know, providing a kind of a, what used in English schools to be called a crib, a very, very literal translation in which every unique Greek word is translated by a unique English word. And I think that's a bad mistake. I've never done that. I assume that my readers, you see, let's put it this way. Over-translation, you know, elaborating, if you like, a bit on the original text, underestimates the intelligence of the original author, because you're kind of, because if the original author, Plato or Epictetus or anybody, had wanted those frills to be in, they'd have put them in themselves, right? And crib-style translation, a very literal translation, underestimates the intelligence of the reader. Because I think readers of my translations can perceive, can understand when, even if I've translated a word differently, it's still the same concept that's being talked about. You know, I think all readers are intelligent enough to do that. So that's another way for me of expressing that balancing act, that tightrope along which you walk, as to between literal accuracy and a degree of latitude.
Rob, did you have a follow up? About
translation.
I'm sure you could start. I don't see Rob anymore.
Wow.
Well, while he's working on reappearing, let me ask you a couple of things. So.
Can I just add a footnote, Massimo?
Yes,
sorry, while we're waiting for Rob. Because there's one very important exception to what I've been saying. And I came across this in particular while translating Epictetus. I've been, you know, usually the philosophers that I translate are people like Plato and Marcus, whose terminology is more flexible. But with Epictetus, he uses a lot more technical stoic vocabulary than I've been used to. And there, of course, you do have to translate literally. You do have to translate key terms the same way every time they come up, because otherwise you're not doing any service to either Epictetus or your readers. So key terms such as assent, desire and aversion, inclination, which is how I translate hormer, those I absolutely translate the same way every time.
Rob is back, which is, and now I just need to make a co-host if I can find him. But in the meantime, while I deal with the technical stuff, oh, there he is. There you are, Rob. You're back.
Hi, Rob.
So,
sorry about that. I don't know what happened. I'm here on campus. It turns out.
Wyoming is far worse than rural Greece, apparently. From the So, Robin, so part of the work you've done, of course, is translating both the discourses and the Enchiridion. Did you find any significant differences there? Because, of course, from a philosophical perspective, those are very different kind of works. Often the Enchiridion is presented as a sort of a summary or you know, very dense version of the discourses. What was your take as a translator?
I do think there are differences. I wouldn't like to pinpoint them, but it's more a question of register or tone of voice. I distinctly read the Enchiridion, the handbook, as Arrian's work. Yes, of course, he's very often in the letter in which he introduces it, he says these are verbatim extracts from discourses, but that's not the case. That's he's simply exaggerating there. But sometimes they are, sometimes they must be verbatim, and sometimes they're accurate paraphrases. But nevertheless, I do feel that I'm reading Arrian rather than hearing Epictetus.
Yeah, right. That's right. So it's so more so, I guess, more strongly in the.
I think Arrian did a brilliant job. Let's not diss him, but to me it's thinner fare than the discourses themselves.
So before we go ahead, Robert, I think you have the next question. But before we go ahead, let me remind our live audience that you guys have an opportunity to ask questions if you like. And the way you do that is you type them in the chat and I'll read them, I'll get them, and then I'll turn them over to Robin as we keep going. So, after that, back to you, Rob.
Oh, okay. So I missed the very end of Robin's response to my last question, but did we talk about prohairesis?
No.
Not yet.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask a couple specific things about translation. I think non-Greek readers, it's sometimes really fascinating to sort of see how we make the decisions that we make and that you've made, right? And so I'm thinking about one word in particular that has caused a lot of trouble historically in trying to understand that, and that's this idea, this Greek term, prohairesis, which has been translated from everything from free will to faculty of choice, and you chose to do you choose will. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the factors at play in how to translate that term, both sort of philological and philosophical, and why you made the choice you did on that.
I have to say it's a term, along with other Stoic technical terms, that make me very jealous of scholars who can simply write, you know, academic articles in learned journals where they can just transliterate. They can just talk about prohairesis rather than having to translate it. It's very, very difficult to translate. Yes, okay, faculty of choice, as you say, some people use, and that is in a sense the most literal translation. The word comes from a Greek root that means choosing. For the Stoics, choosing is something our reason does, our soul does. And it's useful on this point to compare other thinkers like Plato and Aristotle. For Plato and Aristotle, the soul was complex. You remember Plato's famous tripartite division in the Republic. But the complexity of the soul for these people meant that you could act for irrational reasons. For instance, you might retaliate against someone out of anger. But for the Stoics, the soul was rational. And the way we behave is completely determined by our beliefs, which, you know, we read off in the form of propositions. So in that sense, we always rationally choose to act. And I think will is a pretty good translation for rationally choosing to act. Let's spell out will a little bit more. Let's spell out prohairesis a little bit more. According to Epictetus, it's the faculty that makes use of impressions. What he means by that is it gives us the freedom to assent or not to an impression. And again, remember, impressions come to us in the form of propositions. So we actually choose whether or not to assent to a proposition. In itself, then, will is unstoppable in the sense that if we correct our beliefs and judgments, we will always get what we want and act as we intend. That's the Stoic sage. Since nothing and nobody can either compel or hinder our will, it's entirely up to us to choose one action rather than another. So again, will, choice, I think they're very closely aligned here. And I don't think I have anything more to say on this, except, I mean, unless you're going to argue against my own. I do go on. Another thing I should say is that I won't do it now, but I do explain in the introduction why I choose just will and not free will. Because I don't see that will in Epictetus is free will in our sense of the term. But I'm only going to refer people to my introduction for that. And also another reference, the very, very best and very, very clear discussion of these issues is one of the chapters in a book called A Free Will, Origins of the Notion in Ancient Thought by Michael Frader. And I would, as I say, it's very, very readable. And he goes through the whole issue from, as it were, the earlier stages of ancient thought up to Christianity and beyond, maybe beyond. But I do highly recommend that book on this issue.
That is a fine book. Yeah.
The free will issue, free or not, you know, simple will It's, of course, a big issue for anybody interested in Stoicism. And I think you're correct that translating proheisis as free will would be, in fact, incorrect. It would be misleading. Now, in these kind of translations, you make a very good use and an extensive use of footnotes or endnotes, depending on what how the book is actually put together. You know, like I'm thinking, for instance, about your recent translation of Marcus Aurelius. I thought that the endnotes were wonderful. So how did Epictetus compare to Marcus Aurelius in this sense? Did you have to do more of that work, less of that work? Why? What kind of challenges did you have by, you know, if you compare the two, considering, of course, that they're very different authors? For one thing, as we know, Epictetus is not the author. To begin with, but nevertheless, let's say Epictetus. What was your impression of the comparison between the two?
Well, just to give a bit of context, I mean, the reason that I wrote so many footnotes for Marcus was simply because that's what the publisher wanted me to do. They said the way we want this to differ from other translations is not just that it'll be a better translation, hopefully, but that it is specifically the annotated version or the annotated edition or whatever it was they called it on the front cover. And so I came to Epictetus on the back of having done that, brief, having fulfilled that brief for Marcus. And so when I approached Chicago and said, I'd like to do Epictetus for you, and they said, yeah. And I said, but I warn you, I'm going to put a lot of notes in. And they said, that's fine by us. Because, you know, that was the sort of the mode or the mood I was in when approaching these authors. Annotation is, I really like writing notes. But it's very tricky, of course, because you can't actually know what information to give, in the sense that you don't know what information your readers will need in order to make sense of a passage. So probably I tend to over annotate slightly in that respect, in the sense that I'm trying to make everything as comprehensible as possible for my readers. Well, now I wouldn't call it over annotation, but that's my intention when I write notes. I think I've wandered a bit from your original question.
That's okay. Or maybe this is not a conversation.
Yeah. But so I mean, there's always things to annotate. I mean, there are mythological references which not everybody will pick up. There are points of technical stoicism which need bringing out, so that, you know, people understand where, I mean, particularly with Marcus, because Marcus is so accessible to everybody, that the underlying stoicism he's bringing out, so that people understand where Marcus is himself coming from. With Epictetus, that's not such a demand, because, you know, it's pretty clear where he's coming from. Yeah. I think before we leave Epictetus, sorry, this is a complete digression, but I do want to make one thing absolutely clear to the people listening to this conversation, which is that What we have of Epictetus, the discourses, are impromptu, informal talks that he delivered in response to his students' personal issues in the afternoon. They are not the core teaching of the school. Right. The core teaching of the school took place in the mornings and was hardcore stoicism. He would have worked on all the Stoic theory in, you know, the three main branches of Stoic philosophy: logic, physics, and ethics. He'd have gone into the heavy, difficult theory. I mean, Stoic logic is complex. Stoic epistemology is extremely interesting and complex, and he'd have covered all that. What we get in the discourses is the extemporized talks that he delivered in the afternoons, often as he was walking around with his students just having conversation, which also, of course, makes it some kind of a miracle that Arrian managed to preserve so much of those talks. It sometimes boggles my mind as to how he did that. Was he walking around with papyrus and making annotations? I've no idea.
That is a good question. Yeah, how did the logistics work out? Rob, do you think you have a follow-up
question? Yeah, I just have sort of a follow-up on that idea. Does that color how you read you know, the scattered about passages like we find where it's like, oh, so you can read Chrysippus, good for you, right? You know, some people want to take that as, well, he didn't think Stoic logic was important, but your comments here suggest that you think he did think Stoic logic was really important. So
absolutely. He was, as I read him, he was an Orthodox Stoic. He was teaching Orthodox Stoicism, making full use of the treatises of Chrysippus and others during, I mean, we know from what he says in Discourses that that was one of the exercises students had to con a chunk of Chrysippus and then come into the class the next day and explain, read it out and explain it. So we know he was doing all of that stuff. But in the afternoons, he's saying, none of this theory is worth a jot unless you put it into practice. And one of the great values about the Discourses, which I bring out at the end of my introduction, is that there are kind of both explicitly and implicitly within the text, there are a whole series of exercises, practical exercises that he was requiring his students to do in order to drive home this point that theory is worthless without unless it's put into practice. In the mornings, he was an Orthodox Stoic theoretician, I'm sure of it.
Do you mind to expand just a little bit about these practical exercises part? That's going to be something interesting for our audience. And then I have a question or two for you from the audience, in fact.
Okay.
So
I can't hear. You just want me to talk about the exercises.
Yes, exercises.
I mean, there are a whole bunch of them. But let me think off the top of my head of a few of the more interesting ones. Well, we've already mentioned one of them when I was talking earlier about, you know, really what meditations is. So one of them is to have to hand and to hammer home to oneself, to repeat to oneself constantly the important theoretical principles and practical maxims until they've been absorbed by you, until they're kind of like your second nature. That is to say, is I think one of the things that Marcus was doing with his journals. Here's another, to act always with reservation. What the Stoics call reservational adaptation refers to the fact that all future directed inclinations, even rational ones, should always be accompanied by a conditional, because it's always possible for things to go wrong. You might be inclined to eat to preserve your health, but you add the reservation if, you know, inshallah, if God wills it, or something similar. And in this way, a wise man's impulses are never thwarted because he was already expecting impediments. And the importance of not thwarting your impulses is because, as Epictetus says, that's the origin of the emotions, of the pathy.
That's right.
And as we know, the Stoics were not into these passions at all. They wanted apatheia was their ideal state. Okay, one more exercise.
Sure.
A difficult one. Yeah. And one that I don't think anybody else has brought out, but which is to pause and catch the act of ascent before it happens, so that we can check whether the impression is something to which we really want to ascend. Yeah. I mean, can you imagine how difficult that is on a daily basis? Because moment by moment, we're being bombarded by infinite impressions. And yet we have to try to step back. Do we want to ascend to that? Each time and every time. Extremely difficult.
Yes, I would think so. I mean, there's even some pertinent literature in modern psychology about this, you know, can you in fact train yourself to slow down and allow your thoughts to be analyzed.
Oh, interesting.
Take a step back and allow your thoughts to slow down about these things. Yes, you're right. It is difficult. I have a couple of questions from one member of the audience, Anthony.
Sure.
The first one has to do with, he would like to ask you why you chose inclinations instead of impulse and domain instead of topoi, I think he says, in your translation. I'm not positive that is in fact correct. That's what you
said. Sounds perfectly correct. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, domain is a perfectly acceptable translation of topos. So okay. Topos literally means place. That's what it means in ancient Greek, a place. So I don't think it's much of an extended translation to talk about the domains. Inclination for hormer is more interesting. Impulse is certainly the most common translation. Nowadays, one or two people, like Robin Hard's translation of Epictetus, I think he uses motivation rather than impulse. Mm-hmm. But impulse being the most common one, and I did use it for Marcus. I hadn't thought of inclination yet. By the time when I translated Marcus, I used impulse. But I had to add a footnote, because the difficulty with the translation impulse is that it resonates with the English term impulsiveness,
right?
Which is exactly wrong.
That's exactly right. It is wrong. Yeah. In fact, every time that I use with either my students or when I talk more informally about Stoicism, every time that I use the translation, it says impulse. I have to say immediately, but that's not what really
exactly. Inclination. I think what's it's not perfect because it's a fairly sort of weak. Impulse, if you like. It's a fairly weak tendency to say one is, I'm inclined to do this or I'm inclined to do that. But I think it's better, or at least I think it's the best I can come up with at the moment.
Yeah.
If Anthony has any suggestions, I'll happily receive them. My address is all over the place.
I'll ask him. The second question that Anthony has is, how would you compare Epictetus' piety and the importance of God, or his talk about God, to other Greek philosophers that you translated?
Wow.
That seems like an interesting question.
It is. I mean, okay, yes. First of all, let's be clear. Anthony is quite right. Epictetus' Stoicism is shot through with love of God, obedience to God. I mean, God, the way he describes his work is I'm just God's servant, I'm just God's mouthpiece, he says at one point, and the whole thing is, it is a benevolent God. Okay, going back to the some things are up to us and some aren't, the things that aren't up to us, we have to accept because they've actually been given to us by providence, by a benevolent God. Yeah. So it's actually pious of us to accept them and impious not to accept them. And also, as a fun aside, it's their petitionary prayer is therefore impious, because the God being good will do, and providential, will do good to us without our asking for it. So petitionary prayer, according to Epictetus, is a kind of a blasphemy. How does it compare with other translators, other authors I've translated? Well, that's chiefly Plato. I've translated a bit of Aristotle, I've translated quite a bit of Plutarch, I've translated Xenophon on Socrates, but as an original thinker, I think Anthony's probably thinking mostly of Plato. And there I would say that I think Plato was just as devout a person to God or his conception of God, but he's less. I mean, as I keep saying, Epictetus is very in your face. He's very brusque and abrupt. So he's saying this up front all the time, and he's talking about God all the time in an upfront way. Whereas in Plato, it's more muted. I mean, for instance, it's one way you can describe what Plato thought the goal of life was for a human being, was assimilation to God.
Yep.
And when you think about that concept and you read Plato, you keep coming across it or ideas that are compatible with it all over the place. But here's what's really odd, and why I'm mentioning this, is that this was not an issue in Plato's scholarship until like the 1980s or 1990s. Nobody had really sort of drawn this thread of Plato's thought out. So that's what I mean when I say in Plato it's more muted.
Okay.
So muted that his religiosity is sometimes hard to spot. But in Epictetus, it's much more overt.
Thank you. Rob, I think you have the next question, and we're getting close to the end of our conversation, but go for it.
Okay, so I'm debating about what to ask. I got an interesting couple questions from the audience directed to me too, so in the chat. One is from Ranjini, who asks, Robin, if you would say something about Marcus's relationship with Christians in his time, if you have a view about what's gone on there.
Well, I don't think I have a view. I don't know enough of the history of the period. I don't think Marcus talks about the Christians in the Meditations. The one phrase, I think it comes in the 11th journal, I can't remember now, the one phrase in Marcus where in some editions he refers to the journals is a phrase that, in my opinion, should be deleted. So I don't think there's any overt reference to the Christians in the Meditations. What was happening to the Christians in his reign? Yes, they were being persecuted. There was a horrible massacre in, where was it? Some Roman city in what is now France. Mm-hmm. There was a massacre of Christians during Marcus's reign. Was he in a position to stop this? Would he have stopped it if he could? In other words, was he sympathetic to them or hostile to them? I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. I don't think there's enough evidence either way.
Fair enough. Okay. Rob, do you have another question for you, from yourself or the audience before we wrap it up?
Yeah, maybe. I think the question I want to ask might get us a little too deep in the weeds for our time, but
No weeds.
Well, so I wanted to ask. This is perhaps a little bit self-serving, but I think people find it kind of fascinating. I wanted to ask specifically about Enchiridion 8, or Handbook 8, Section 8. Mm-hmm. It's a short little one, but it's super dense, and different translators offer translations that are often very similar, but maybe importantly different, right? So you translate, instead of wishing that things would happen as you'd like, wish that they would happen as they do, and then you'll be content. Mm-hmm. Just by way of comparison, Tony Long's recent translation of the Enchiridion translated, don't ask for things to happen as you would like them to, but wish them to happen as they actually do, and you'll be all right. So you have, for example, content, where he has all right. There's all these wishing and wanting languages there, bits of language there. And I wonder if you could say something about, like, maybe by way of comparing what you chose as opposed to what.
I think they're both essentially the same. Tony is more accurate, literally accurate at the beginning. Don't ask for things is a more accurate translation than instead of wishing for things. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to bring out the balance between the two halves of the sentence. So I used wish in both halves. Where I think my translation is better is then you'll be content, rather than Tony's you'll be all right, because all right seems a bit casual. And the Greek term involved, if I remember rightly, is euroio, which is a verb that literally means you'll be flowing smoothly. Going right back to Zeno, the founder of Stoicism,
right,
he actually defined happiness as a smoothly flowing life.
Yep.
So it is kind of a technical term within Stoicism, and it's one that both in Marcus and in Epictetus I translate as contentment. And I think that's slightly better than Tony's all right.
Do you think there's different sort of valences to the ideas of wish and want? And
I hate this issue because I have to worry about it all the time.
Yeah.
Yes, many people tell me that there are such different valences between wish and want, and sometimes I can detect them, but sometimes I simply lump for the more common want, because wish sounds a bit old-fashioned.
Yeah.
I mean, we generally just say, you know, I want to go to the seaside. We don't say, I wish to go to the seaside.
Right, right. So sounds a little bit genie in the bottle-ish or something like that.
Something, a little bit priggish perhaps or something, I don't know. Yeah. But so I very often plump for want when extreme pedants would want me to write wish. if I can charge them with pedantry.
Okay, we are basically at the end. Robin, one more question, and that should be an easy one. What's your next project? What are you working on now or plan on working on in the near future?
Well, okay. As usual, I've got, I don't know, how many books have I got on go at the moment? Three. That's about normal. I'm finishing with a co-author a translation of some books of the historian Cassius Dio, who wrote Roman history but in Greek. I'm just doing the translation. I mean, I've done it, and somebody else is doing the introduction and notes. I'm in the process of seeing through, I'm expecting now the final proofs of a biography of Plato, which is going to be published by Oxford University Press. And do you know what? This is the first ever book-length biography of Plato.
I was going to say, I never heard of anything like that.
But that's, I mean, how weird
strange.
Is that?
That is,
I mean, well, there are very good scholarly reasons for that. I mean, the evidence is thin, and sometimes, you know, I mean, a lot of scholars actually don't accept the authenticity of any of the Platonic letters, which are our main source for at least a certain aspect of his life. But I accept the authenticity of three of them. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to write the biography in the first place. So there's that. And thirdly, I'm about, I don't know, two-thirds of the way through a translation of Thucydides, the historian Thucydides. Again, I won't be writing the translation and notes, the introduction and notes, because, you know, he's a very kind of specialist subject, and I wanted to leave that to an expert. So a friend called Polly Lowe is going to do that. So I think the Plato book, the biography, I don't know. I can't see another original book on my horizon. I can see a lot more translation on my horizon, but I can't see another original book. But you know, you say that and then suddenly you get a good idea. So
yeah, exactly. that's been my experience. Well, thanks very much. This was really fascinating as usual. We've done it again. We engaged in another hour of what we call practical philosophy. So many thanks to Rob, of course, and to our guest, Robin Waterfield, and also to our live audience. Thanks both of you and everybody else for being here today.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed myself.
Thank you. Now, of course, if you wish to hear past episodes of Philosophy as a Way of Life, go to anchor.fm/philosophy as a way of life, or check us out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and a bunch of other things. You know, the usual stuff. Robin, again, it was a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I hope we have we've done it twice now. I hope we have an opportunity to do it again. What's your interest in Thucydides?
Yeah, well, it's I reread, in fact, the
history
more recently. So, I've definitely read it. All right. Everybody,
all right,
else,
bye. Thank you.
Good night and stay safe.
Bye, everybody. Thank you. Thank you for coming.